Hello, can everybody hear me? Great. I just wanted to set the record straight. I used to be the director of research at the Office of Rural Health Policy, but I retired, and so now I have more time to go to meetings and to travel, too. So I recommend it. When the time comes for you to retire, you're going to love it. I'm really going to take a very different perspective on looking at issues concerning long-term care insurance. And I wanted to ask the audience, how many of you have lived or worked in a rural area? Can you raise your hand? Oh, we do have a few people. Great, that's wonderful. I've given presentations where no one has been in a rural area. And as you know, they're very, very different. So first I had wanted to talk a little bit about the need for long-term care and then talk about the purchase of long-term care insurance and the receipt of the long-term care services. If you take a look at the urban elderly and you compare them to the rural elderly, you'll see that there's a shorter life expectancy. The news is kind of very bleak. The rural elderly are more likely to have chronic conditions, and as you know, those can often lead to disabilities and the need for long-term care insurance. And they spend a longer time in a disabled state. When we look at the need for help with activities for daily living and instrumental activities, we find that the number of years that are lived in a state of disability, the disability life years, is greater for the rural elderly, and in particular for the rural minority elderly. And the situation for rural is further complicated because the rural elderly are poorer and less educated, and they may have lost family supports. Because as the census tells us, more and more of the working age children tend to migrate to urban areas looking for employment opportunities. So they also have some extra challenges in seeking and receiving care due to the basic things like long travel distances and mountainous terrain and very extreme weathers. I think if you think about Montana and Alaska, there are two good examples, but there are quite a few problems there with just trying to get to care. And then many of them live in remote areas, and there is really a dearth of health professionals and health providers to give care. One of the critical issues about long-term care insurance for the rural population is the access to the array of long-term care services and supports. And here I'm talking about things like community-based and home-based care, home health, different types of physical and speech therapy, mental health services, hospice. The concern is that for the rural areas is that these services and the health professionals that provide them are generally aren't available. Rural persons who live in places that are adjacent to urban areas are the lucky ones if they have access to travel to the urban area, or sometimes the urban providers come around to them like a circuit rider. But those people who live in remote areas or even in rural places who are not adjacent to urban areas have limited to no access to health professionals who provide long-term care. In a remote area, you cannot find a mental health professional or a therapist, which is something that we take for granted because we live in an urban area. The lack of long-term care providers in rural areas is really the biggest challenge to providing long-term care services and supports there. Having long-term care insurance, I think, is extremely important, and we've been spending a lot of time talking about that today. But having health professionals who can provide you with some long-term care services is also an essential factor. Possible approaches for this access challenge is they're already out there when you think about it. They're providing scholarships for training the long-term care workforce and then requiring some kind of a payback of several levels of service in rural areas. And you all recognize that. That's the National Health Service Corps model. There are two proven strategies to obtaining physicians for rural areas, for example, and one of them is giving priority to rural students when you give scholarships, and the other is requiring residency practicums in rural areas. So these are really not any new ideas, but they need to be applied so that they can be helped to build the workforce there. There can also be another strategy applied, which is improving access by, again, adopting the model of training nurse practitioners to expand the physician workforce. And here what I'm suggesting is that you take that approach and you apply it to all of the health professions that you're looking to grow in rural areas, the therapists, the mental health providers. And I realize, of course, you've got to do special training for each one of those professions. And you also have to revise the scope of practice law state by state, and that's a real, real hot political issue, believe me. But I think it's worthwhile to take a look at these policy options because of the seriousness of the access problems there. Cash benefits are fine, but if you need a therapist or you can't find one, you have to address that as a particular problem. The other issue I had wanted to mention was looking at eligibility to purchase long-term care insurance, and I think this goes back to the CLASS Act, which requires a certain work history in order to be eligible. And I have a very different take on this issue than Josh has, and it's the fact that many rural folks have been working their entire life, but they have what's called an intermittent work history because there are occupations where they're employed only part of the year, like farming and ranching, different kinds of constructions and other kinds of fishing businesses. So the eligibility process when these people get there is that these intermittent work histories need to be kind of built into the implementation so that the people who get there suddenly don't find out that they've got to have all kinds of extra documentation in order to prove how eligible they are for the services. I wanted to also mention about the payment of premiums, and that goes into the problem where the rural are poorer than their urban counterparts, which makes the payments of insurance premium a challenge for them. And so, of course, one of the possibilities here as a policy option is subsidies, and another is looking at not only a sliding fee scale based on age, but also one based on poverty. It also raises the issue that Josh was mentioning about whether things should be voluntary or they should be mandatory. Again, people who are poor take a very close look at how they're spending their dollars, and oftentimes you'll see that people talk a lot about the underinsured in rural areas, that they're only investing in insurance for a very small amount in order to kind of, quote, save the farm if they get a really catastrophic illness, but that large premiums really scare them off from any type of insurance purchase. I also wanted to talk a little bit about implementation, although I right at this point we're not into that kind of a phase, but just 2 weeks ago, AOA was working really hard at thinking about implementation, and I wanted to talk about marketing of the plan. And it's because electronic communication in rural areas is really a challenge and a problem. Not all rural areas are wired for electronic communication. It's the long distances and the sparse density of the population as makes broadband less economically feasible than in urban areas. I have the opportunity to choose several broadband services here in the Washington area, but in rural, sometimes there aren't any. How many of you have had the experience of traveling to a rural area and finding out that your cell phone didn't work? Yes, right. And that's one of the, that's a really good example of the problems with electronic communications. So any kind of marketing campaign that depends on electronic communication is just not going to reach many of the rural population. You need to think about basic things like mail and newspapers and TV and radio, even face-to-face discussions. A lot of communities spend time, a lot of time at the church, at the library, at Rotary, at Walmarts. There's a lot of Walmarts in rural areas, and those would be good places for any kind of marketing efforts. And again, looking forward, when long-term care benefits are available in a type of long-term care insurance, I think that a hotline is really essential to answer questions and to handle problems. For rural, some education sessions need to be held so that they can understand more fully just exactly what long-term care insurance is and how it would meet their needs. And the last point I wanted to make is to talk about review and revise. Again, this is looking forward to actual implementation of long-term care insurance. But I think I've been trying to tell you about some of the problems that are unique to rural places and populations. And so I'm suggesting also that policymakers build in a rapid review and revision of the rural aspects of any long-term care insurance program. And I think that's critical, not only looking at what's happening in the national when things are being implemented, but taking a special look at what's happening in rural. We found that results of numerous research studies that look at rural health services have shown that approaches that work in urban areas, surprise, often don't work in rural areas. And this is because of the big differences in the infrastructure and the lack thereof and population characteristics. This is really especially true for remote rural areas where you cannot take what you found in a urban research study and apply it to a remote area and have it work. When I'm speaking about this reviewing and revising the implementation of long-term care insurance in rural places, I'm really not talking about a formal program evaluation that's conducted several years after the fact, after the program is in place. Rather, I'm advocating something like an action research where you do a rapid review and revise during each phase of the implementation while it's ongoing. This is so you can take a look at the small glitches and resolve them before they become major problems. In this rapid review, particular attention needs to be paid to three questions. Is the rural population enrolling at the same rate as the urban population? I think that's a very important one. Is the rural population receiving their long-term care benefits in a timely fashion? That's more an implementation issue. And is the rural population able to obtain the needed services? And that's an access issue. I'd like to just close with this one observation. The need for long-term care insurance is great for the rural population, and I've tried to touch on that a bit. But as policymakers are designing a national program, they need to address the differences between urban and rural places and populations. It's really a matter of equity that rural populations have that same opportunity to buy long-term care insurance and receive appropriate long-term care services to meet their needs. Thank you.
Okay, so I see a lot of people in this audience who I know have a lot of experience also. So I thought at this point what we would do would be to open it for questions from the audience for any of the expert panelists. And I see somebody jumping up and down in the back. I assume it's a little ADD, Alan.
Yeah, I guess for Josh, just to comment in the stream and the evolution, I guess that would have included the Claude Pepper Commission and some of the early attempts again to cover long-term care. And clearly, you know, with the political environment, we need a champion. We need somebody that could really push this through. And unfortunately, Senator Kennedy is not with us anymore. But the question I have relates to lowering the burden of cost of long-term care through efforts like changing the built environment, the whole notion of lifelong communities, giving empowerment, you know, John, to the communities, with neighbors and people look after their own, whether it's a morgue or you know, a village model. Do you think those kinds of approaches and changes could, in fact, decrease the burden of long-term care costs?
Well, in my notes, I had a reference to the Pepper Commission. I just didn't have a chance to talk about it. Having testified before the Pepper Commission, I wouldn't want to leave that one out. So, as to whether there are other mechanisms to reduce the cost of long-term care, such as built environments and naturally occurring retirement communities, I guess I would say I'm in favor of all those things. They seem like good things to do. But you got to show me the beef in terms of the evidence that can, A, be implemented on a large-scale basis, and B, that it has, on a population basis, an ability to reduce expenditures. In general, we have not done terribly well in terms of finding ways to reduce long-term care costs from a public perspective, in part because we already have an institutional bias, so a lot of people don't want to use services. If they're eligible for Medicaid, they have to contribute all of their income towards the cost of care and only get to be covered after they've impoverished themselves and used up all of their other assets, and we underpay providers relative to the private sector. So it's not so easy to get savings in long-term care, and obviously we all continue to need to look that way, but I don't think that just doing those kinds of things are going to substantially reduce the premiums. And as Connie alluded to, if we're looking at either a mandatory or a voluntary program, the out-of-pocket cost needs to be maybe at most around $30 a month. Beyond that, and we did a similar survey to what Steve was talking about in Hawaii as part of some work we're doing for the Hawaii Long-Term Care Commission. And there was a lot of people, not a majority, but there were a lot of people, 20, 30, 40% of the population, that'd be willing to pay $30 a month. But the number of people who were willing to pay $150 a month was about 1 or 2%. So if the goal is to get large numbers of people to have meaningful coverage, somehow we have to get the coverage down, or excuse me, get the premium down. That may mean some kind of either a premium subsidy or making it mandatory.
I don't think the issue of getting the cost both of long-term care in terms of premiums as well as the cost of the service is off the table. And I honestly think now is a window. What's really interesting in terms of the actuaries that looked at the Class Act, if you talk to the actuaries from CBO, and I just went through all my 104 emails from CBO last night, just for my own benefit, and there's what's interesting is when you look at what the assumptions are, because that drives what the participation rate in those assumptions really drives, again, what your risk pool is, and then you have to look at the composition of the risk pool, and then you have to look at the degree of disability in the out years. And I looked at it up against what some of the industry actuaries had actually decided. And so CBO actually, and this is not to debate your cost for the premium, but CBO actually, when they looked at Class Act and they took the parameters, snapshot in time, this is an example, said, we're going to look at this snapshot in time, $75 a day for 2.5 ADLs at a 5% participation rate, and they believed we could get a 5% participation rate because it was a different animal than a long-term care insurance. Now, the other side of it gave a 2% participation rate. The degree of disability in the out years was very different from CBO than it was from the traditional insurance industry. And if you look at even the AARP journals that come out, you can see where the degree of disability is in the out years very different. And so I think, you know, a lot of this, and they told me this because it's new and different, is a crapshoot, and you're not going to know until you know. And so, you know, the sad part about where we are right now is that a plug was pulled before it was allowed to die of its own weight, because we don't know what would have happened. So that was the CBO people, when they came up with the estimate, they said for an average 50-year-old with the way the parameters were at a 5% participation rate, that the average premium was $123 a month. Now that's them. $200 and some odd, I think, is what Josh just quoted. And yet the fellow who worked with me in our office who had the government long-term care insurance with John Hancock, who had a disease that clearly was not going to cause a lot of anything if you took care of yourself over time, was paying $450 a month. He was very risk-averse. I was trying to see if he could find all his friends so they could sign up for Class. So I think it's just really hard. But those variables and what those assumptions are matter. And if we pick up always what the current industry's assumptions are based on their model, it's hard. So I think that would change. As far as how do you work with communities, the other thing that's unfortunate is in the Class Act, the only thing people look at is the fiduciary triangle that's in there. Should we leave it or should we not? There's a whole lot of other stuff in Class Act that's got nothing to do with the premium stuff. It has to do with programs in there to help people understand what to do with their life. There is two big advisory panels, one that was very important to look at what the caregiving capacity was in a state. And that wasn't only about Class, but you got no business doing Medicaid waivers and promising people you can't deliver. And so you can do all the waivers you want, but if you don't have the personal care attendants out there, the nursing staff, whoever, to do it, then you've wasted your time and you've wasted your tax dollars. So not only, you know, if Class stops, does that fiduciary piece, you know, go away, but a lot of the other pieces in there that really informed the system as a whole also kind of go away. But I think, you know, I think it's a good point about communities, and I think Medicaid is an example of it. You can go 10 miles into Virginia here, and you're going to see an ICFMR sitting on great track land with good people working there, with a university right across the street. And I asked the question of the state of Virginia, why is it you can't turn that into a neighborhood? Why can't you have a 7-Eleven for people to work in? Why can't you take elderly, you know, whoever the ICFMR population is that's Medicaid? Why don't you bring the students and the Allied Health Services over to learn about what those, why don't you do that? And the same workers from the ICFMR can certainly redesign what they do each day and work in that neighborhood as well. So I think the more we begin to think about this, I think this is an opportunity. Washington Post had an article yesterday that talked about what the composition of the world looks like right now. It was fascinating. People looked at it. They talked about the infertility rate, whether it was conscious or unconscious. It has dropped. And so you've got not as many young people per older people. And so we're talking about a world that's going to be designed about 50 and up now. And so now's the time to keep this conversation going. So I don't think it's as bleak as what others may think.
There's a question in front. Oh, did you want to mention something too? Okay. And then after Jen, we'll take the question in front.
I think that in rural community is one of its strengths because It's smaller, people know each other, and they're able to assist each other and help people to find assistance. AOA has certain mechanisms where they help identify various kinds of supports and services that are available to help some of the people that need assistance. So I think that kind of community strength in these small places are things that would perhaps help cost, but certainly help access to a different variety of services. If the service is there, people will find it. I think part of what I talked about is some of the services aren't there, and those may be the higher cost ones. So it also may be that in rural, the costs are lower because of what's available to provide help.
Question? Susan, do you want to come up? Because the acoustics in this room are dreadful.
We did do a study looking at Medicare and Medicaid expenditures when residents choose hospice. And in the last month of life, there was pretty much overall no difference, but for people with short stays, there was a huge savings to Medicare, mostly hospitalizations, and for different, depending on the diagnosis, for Alzheimer's, it cost a little more. It all related to the underlying hospitalization rate. So residents that used more hospital, there were more savings with hospice, and those who used less, there were fewer savings. But essentially, for about the first 4 weeks on hospice, there's a savings. And as many of you know, there's a lot of controversy now about the long hospice stays. But there's also twice as many short stays under 7 days. And those actually, you don't necessarily see all the savings because the opportunity to save the hospitalizations didn't occur, per se.
Thank you. That's Susan Miller, who's current chair of the Aging and Public Health section. Anybody else have a question before we go back? Anybody else on the side here?
I was wondering if someone on the panel could deal with us ignoramuses who may not know what was in the Class Act. Is there a way to just very briefly outline that for us?
Sure. It was an infrastructure, and so we offered a couple different things. On the money side of things, in terms of an eventual program that we would ask the secretary to develop using her internal mechanisms as well as these advisory panels, which never got appointed, what we did was we said, we need a program that's a cash model. We need to not have underwriting. We'd like to see a lifetime benefit. And we said there are three parameters to it. One is you can never start the program once you are eligible for a benefit. Okay, you need to have at least two ADLs, but you could always start the program at three. If you really want to be conservative, you all know who work in this. There's a big difference between two ADLs and three ADLs. So we said never less than two ADLs. You can, at that point, we said not less than two ADLs. You can never offer less than the average of $50 a day, but we want to see a range. So if you say two ADLs for $50 a day, then three ADLs for $100, we wanted to see a range in there, and then the lifetime benefit. For the working piece of it, what we did, and again, we had 17 changes that we would have considered continuing to make, except that politics got in the way of it. We never had a conference on the big health care reform bill, so we never got to make those changes. However, the person in charge of the division in HHS who was working on it assured us that they had the flexibility flexibility to accommodate 95% of those changes. I'm not sure what happened there, but they said they could accommodate those. But the other piece that we had in there was the work requirement. And because we wanted to make sure that people with functional limitations didn't get aced out of this program, and also that very healthy people that stayed home wouldn't get aced out of it, because there's this assumption in the insurance industry that if you're at home, you must be sick. But that gets rid of a lot of stay-at-home moms that drive the bus in the morning and do piano lessons in the afternoon. It's wrong to assume that people that are home are necessarily sick, but that's an assumption that, that the actuaries on the outside believed. But we said that you did have to have a work requirement in order to enroll in the program, and then the eligibility criteria would be, you know, no less than two ADLs, no more than, you know, no less than at the average of $50 a day. And so we gave them parameters to move around. There were ways that we believe you could have done this. You don't have to offer just a lifetime benefit. We would argue you could offer three different kinds of plans, but one of them has to be a lifetime benefit, which you could have offered a shorter period. There are things that we'll discuss in the future about how to rearrange some of the deck chairs on this, maybe. But that's one piece of it. The second piece that was in it was some money that went to all the protection and advocacy systems in every state to work with people who did have this benefit around how to use it correctly and what the resources were that were available, including the use of this to do some end-of-life planning if you wanted to use it for that. Okay, now that's not a death panel thing. That was just your availability to be able to do that. And that was a Republican amendment that was actually put in it. That's in it. There's this advisory panel in there to look at direct care, what the capacity of the state is to actually deliver the kinds of care that people might want with their dollars, but also around this Medicaid waiver issue as well. And we actually were so tight with it, we tied it to the state plan and said, you're not going to get your money on your state Medicaid plan unless you've got some sense of what your workforce is that's out there to be able to do it. Now, would it have stayed that way had we had a conference? Probably not, because that's a pretty left way of thinking about things, but it begins the conversation. So there's a lot of those kinds of pieces that were in it that unfortunately go down if this goes down. Again, we're hoping that the infrastructure will stay put and give us the time necessary to think about how to do this or another plan and then take that one away. But we feel like if that doesn't stay up there right now, whether you like it or whether you don't, there's no pressure on the Republicans and Democrats in the Congress to do something about the issue. That would be the only reason to keep it and not repeal it right now from our perspective. White House may have a different perspective in terms of repealing a piece of health care reform. I don't know. So, but those were kind of the main pieces that were in the CLASS Act that I think, an issue. You know, we did have the voluntary opt-out, as you say, in there originally, and that got, talked about that earlier, that got stripped out. We also had the benefit on a thing called an independence card. And so when you got your benefit, it would be on an independence card, so you would have some track of what you used your money for. The other thing is, where'd this money go? We didn't want it to go into Social Security, because there's always an issue with Social Security, so we left it in HHS. But one could make the argument, but we never got to that point, that because this is a pool of money, the way this is invested, although now is not a good time to talk about it, then was, but the way it could be invested wouldn't necessarily have to be in government bonds only. There are ways that you could do it. It wasn't an individual entitlement like Social Security is. It was a pool of money, but we never did get to that piece of the conversation. What I think is most interesting, though, around the cost piece of it is, about 3 weeks ago, the Minister of Health from Israel was over here, and he came to see me. He asked for all of the legislation and the language, because he said, they're going to do it over there, even though we may not do it here. And I said, and he said, they have a voluntary program in Israel with 65% of their population signed up for it. And when he explained to me what the benefit was, it wasn't even close to kind of as much as we might be able to get out of, you know, a reconfiguration of this. And he kept saying to me, why didn't you make it mandatory? And I said, because this country doesn't deal well with mandatory. We can't get mandatory vaccines. People don't want to get immunized. I mean, it's just mandatory is really hard. And he must have said this to me with his accent, you know, four or five times. Why are you not making it mandatory? Why are you not making it mandatory? And finally I said, I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm married to a Jewish doctor or I'm a shiksa. So I don't know why we didn't make it mandatory, you know. So he just laughed finally. And he said, well, we're going to take it back and we're going to do it. And we'll let you know if it works or not. So that was a little disconcerting. But they have 65% in voluntary enrollment over there. So, well, what I think would be good for us to do is a voluntary opt-out program. If we could do it and start it with the government, start it with the federal government, the benefits that the federal government offers. Just start with them, federal government, and then the military would be part of that. A lot of the state governments do it, and see where it goes. I mean, and just see what happens. That'd give you a pretty big risk pool if you're able to do that. But these are all things that we hope the conversation doesn't stop.
Thanks. So we have time for about one more question. Yeah.
Connie and Josh especially, what do you think, aside from what you just mentioned, Connie, what do you think are the next steps to engage all the stakeholders and keep the conversation going?
Well, for the folks that I work with, the next steps are to make sure that Class Act, whatever you want to say about it, doesn't get repealed. Because, again, it keeps pressure on people to do something. And if it's not that, then it needs to be something else. And I think what we'd like to see, whether it happens or not, is an amendment, when the repeal comes up, an amendment to say, let's keep this in place, keep it here, work under that umbrella for the next 18 months, then put a hard repeal. And at that point in time, if you haven't brought the right people to the table and you haven't really analyzed this thing, then it is what it is, and we should fully fund Medicare and take the poverty bed off of it and call it a day, is what I think. But I think it hasn't had the time necessary with the right people at the table to be able to have the conversation about whether we really want to throw in the towel on long-term services and supports or whether we don't. And it's really about that. It's about this fragmented system. Class was just an infrastructure to work under, but that fragmented system, I think everyone agrees, needs to be pulled together in a better way. That's where I think it's going. Josh thinks something different.
Well, I think there needs to be a continuing conversation about this, and I think that it all depends on the political environment. I believe that it is possible to put some legislative or to design some legislative fixes that would address many of the concerns about class, but the current environment is not conducive to that discussion. But it is absolutely certain, there is no two ways about it, that with the aging of the population, the number of people with disabilities is going to increase, even if the disability rate falls dramatically. So there's going to be a need for more long-term care services, and some way or another, we need to find a way to pay for it. For all of my career up to this point, I have always believed that Americans would be able to muddle along, that most of the projections were that the public spending for long-term care would increase from about 1% of GDP to maybe 2%, maybe 3% of GDP, which is a big percentage increase, but on an absolute level is kind of manageable if you're a grown-up and an adult about it. But I'm not so sure that Americans are up to that task anymore, and I'm quite fearful about what's going to happen for the future, because there is just no way that you can serve three times as twice as many people who need services for the same amount of money. And we've got to be willing to put more money into the system. And what was particularly attractive about class was it was a whole new revenue stream outside of the normal Medicaid and Medicare route. And, at least for the short term, we're not going down that route now. And we've got to try to find, and private insurance, we've got 25 years of experience and we know it's a niche product. So we're kind of stuck. And, I'm not sure where we're going. But we got to figure out a way because, I'm going to be 85 one day. I'm going to need services.
Jen, did you have any final comments?
My take on the future and looking at where the CLASS Act is going and where long-term care insurance is going is that rural experts and rural advocates need to be involved in the process and look at things through the rural lens and the rural perspective. The advisory committees, the people who are working on designing things and working on implementing things need to have people that bring the expertise and the knowledge and understanding of rural there so that rural people have a chance to avail themselves of the insurance and the services.
Any of us comment? Okay, Alan, you get the last word.
Connie, could you just please plug your website?
Plug the website?
Advocates.
Oh, the current website. We have a website. It's easy to get to. It's advanceclass.org.
So that's advanceclass, advanceclass.org.
Okay.
And on that website they will find?
Well, you'll find all the history of CLASS, but then you'll also find some of the real stories of people that are out there that need to get this problem solved. There's ways that you can sign up where we contact you just with our information. There's no cost associated with that to keep up to date on what's going on with things. That's probably the biggest value of it right now. We don't have Twitter up yet, Kate, and we don't have any Facebook stuff. I'm not very good on that, so I rely on my admin assistant, Kate, back there to put that stuff up because I don't even know how to work Facebook. But eventually we'll get to some social media. Thanks to
Cambridge. Great, thanks. So while the CLASS Act is in mothballs for the moment, I think the panel, not mothballs. Okay, it's not mothballs. While the CLASS Act has been hobbled for a few days and needs some long-term care to make it independent again, I think the panelists today provided some really good insights as to where we came from and how we might get it going again, and I want to thank all of you and give them one more round of applause. And I want to thank you all for your interest and efforts, and hopefully next year when we have this panel, it'll be on the resurrection of the CLASS Act. Thanks.